Who was the most dominant team in pro football history? The 1972 Miami Dolphins? How about the 1948 Cleveland Browns? They were both undefeated champions of their respective leagues. Or maybe Lombardi's Packers. Or even the 85 Bears. Not so fast. There was a team in mainstream professional football that excelled beyond any of those mentioned above. My name's Darren Hayes, and I'm the author of a book, The World's Greatest Pro Gridiron Team, the 1903 Franklin All-Stars. And I'm proud to say that the Sports History Network is giving away a signed copy of this book to a lucky winner in our latest giveaway, where you can sign up at sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways and get your name entered today. Good luck. We have a great program in store for you today. We're going to talk about a couple of great football legends, actually three of them, that you'll really enjoy. And as well as we're going to talk about even more legends who wore the number three in the NFL with our special guest, once again, Oz Davis. It's all coming up in just a moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we're broadcasting from the Pig Pen in Western Pennsylvania to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with the tunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes once again from the Pig Pen in Western Pennsylvania. I'm from pigskindispatch.com, and the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch is here for you with our football history headlines for February 14th, Valentine's Day. And Valentine's Day is for lovers, and this program is for football lovers, and we have plenty of it for you today, because first we're going to do our regular football history headlines, and today it's just three birthdays of Hall of Fame legends that we're going to talk about, and then we're going to go into our jersey number threes, our football by the numbers, as we're on number three. And again, we have Oz Davis from the Truly the Goats and the SHN Showcase podcast on the Sports History Network. We'll get to him in just a moment. But let's talk about our legends on their birthdays for this February 14th. And we'll start off in year 1913. Clifton, Ohio, the Ohio State University coaching legend Wayne Woodrow Hayes was born. No relation. We know him better as Woody Hayes, the Buckeyes frontman from 1951 through 1978. Woody was a large personality and he commanded attention. The Buckeyes led the nation in home attendance in 21 of Woody's 28 years at OSU. Hayes' offensive football strategy was the old 3 yards in a cloud of dust. In fact, the National Football Foundation floats it out there that Hayes may have created the phrase. Not this Hayes. The NFF bio goes on to say how Hayes' coaching produced 3 Heisman Trophy winners and 51 first-team All-American selections. That's unbelievable numbers. The Buckeyes under Woody Hayes took national championship titles in years of 1954, 1957, 1961, 68, and 1970. He majored in English in college and always emphasized educational values in talks with his players. He wasn't without controversy, though, as an SI.com article points out. Hayes was well-earned reputation for losing his temper. There was a time he shoved a cameraman at the Rose Bowl, and a time he destroyed the sideline markers near the end of a loss to Michigan. But his biggest tirade, and unfortunately his last impression on the football world, was his infamous punching of a Clemson player at the Gator Bowl on December 29, 1978. The action that ended Hayes' long tenured coaching career. Woody Hayes, despite all of that, was enshrined into the College Football Hall of Fame for all his great legendary records in 1983. February 14, 1919, Brookline, Massachusetts. Boston College's legendary guard George Kerr was born. Kerr played on the Eagles gridiron from 1938 through the 1940 seasons per the National Football Foundation's online bio of him. The Righteous Reject, as he was called at Boston College, reported to his coach the first time wearing multiple layers of sweaters and jackets to boost his weight some 25 pounds heavier than he actually was to give him that appearance of a much larger man's stature. What the coach saw, though, was his big heart and desire to succeed at football. Through his hard work and dedication, Kerr went from the 6th team at BC to receiving an All-America mention. Kerr helped to post a 26-3-2 record in 3 seasons with the Boston College Eagles, and his outstanding Sugar Bowl performance against Tennessee earned him a place on the all-time Sugar Bowl team. George Kerr received the great honor of being selected for inclusion into the College Football Hall of Fame in 1984. Our last legend of the game, who has a birthday today, was February 14th, 1960, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The outstanding quarterback from the Miami Hurricanes program, Jim Kelly, was born. The Buffalo Bills selected Kelly in the first round of the 1983 NFL draft, but the signal caller decided to sign with the USFL's Houston Gamblers franchise instead. The 6'4", 225-pound quarterback spent two seasons with the Gambler and threw for, listen to this, 9,842 yards and a whopping 83 touchdowns in two seasons per the ProFootballHOF.com website. When the USFL folded, Jim signed with the NFL team that he originally drafted him, the Bills, in 1986. It was a perfect fit for both parties, as Kelly ran the famed no-huddle, fast-paced offense of Coach Marv Levy to a T. Having the offensive weapons like running back Thurman Thomas and wide receivers Andre Reed and James Lofton for a period of time didn't hurt either. The Bills played in four straight Super Bowls in the 1990s, led by Kelly's arm. In Jim's 11 seasons with the Bills, he led the Bills to the AFC playoffs eight times. In those 17 playoff appearances, including the four Super Bowls, Kelly tossed the ball for 3,863 yards and 21 touchdowns. Jim Kelly was enshrined into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in the year 2002. Now, in a little bit of a transition here, I want to thank all of you that have gone on the website, pigskindispatch.com, and pulled down that Buy Me a Cup of Coffee tab and bought me a cup of coffee, because doing this program, a lot of coffee is needed to keep the energy up here, and it's greatly appreciated for those of you that have contributed to buy the cup of coffee. And if you'd like to, like I said, go to pigskindispatch.com, go to up to near the top, it says Buy Me a Cup of Coffee, pull that tab down. There's some instructions on how you can throw a couple bucks in the can for getting a coffee for the old pig pen here. So, like we promised earlier, we are going to go into our series on the football by numbers and jersey number three. So let's kick that over to that special guest right now, Oz Davis and Football by Numbers. Okay, tonight's episode, we are going to talk in our journey going through all the jersey numbers of football, 0 through 99. We are on the jersey number 3 tonight, and we have kind of a historic moment here on the podcast. Our first returning guest, Oz Davis, is going to be helping in discussion tonight for jersey number 3. We had such a great time last night in the number 2s. If you haven't caught that episode, please make sure you go back and check it out after you're done listening to this one, because we had a good time. It's just like we're going to have tonight. So we want to talk about the significant players in pro football history. And Oz Davis, as just to remind you, he is on the Sports History Network's Truly the Goats podcast. He also does the SHN Showcase podcast. Mr. Oz Davis, welcome to the Pigpen.
All right. Great to be back.
Okay. Well, now tonight we have a night I know you've been waiting for. Because when I said I was going to do a series on jersey numbers, I had, you know, one guy with his hand up saying, "Ooh, pick me for number 3, pick me for number 3." And I think there might be some favorite players or a favorite player that you want to talk about tonight.
But I also want number 80, too, by the way. So keep
number
in mind
80.
For that.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Okay.
Keep me in mind for that. Okay. In any case, well, yeah, there's a couple of big number 3s. It's also interesting to note that. I've got a good trivia question for you, too. The number 3 is really crucial in at least a couple of other sports, if you're talking great uniform numbers. Of course, in baseball, that's Babe Ruth.
Oh, yeah.
And in NASCAR, that was Dale Earnhardt.
Right,
Most people still consider the GOAT NASCAR driver. But do you know why Babe Ruth wore number 3?
No, I don't.
It's actually a real simple answer. He batted third. The Yankees, of course, are famous for Lou Gehrig wore number 4. The Yankees, of course, are famous for being the only team in Major League Baseball that doesn't have the names on the back of the jersey. However, they were the first team to put the numbers on the jerseys in baseball because they wanted everybody to know who their stars were.
So interesting. So Ruth didn't bat cleanup. Gehrig got batted cleanup, huh?
Oh no! Famously not. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was always Ruth Gehrig.
I'm a football historian, not a baseball historian. Yeah. It just seems odd to me, though.
Always okay. It's funny too because if you play the 27 Yankees in Sim or something, and you let the computer set the lineup, invariably they'll put Gary third and Ruth fourth. It was much more logical, but you know, Ruth had the ego. So in any case, number number three, it actually turns out to be a really important number in NFL football history too. You know, we talked last episode, I won't reveal any names or anything, but we talked last episode about how these low numbers, when you talk about greats to wear them, it's really important, or you really get a nice look at the early days of football, because back in those days, you know, the low numbers were taken by the important guys, just like the Yankees in the 20s in baseball. And so, you know, your number ones, your number twos, your threes were the key players on that team. There wasn't much of a, you know, there wasn't like we have nowadays, which is actually quite a logical system, where, you know, your linemen were in the 60s and your backs are 20s and 30s and quarterbacks are teens and whatnot. So, but they didn't have that back in those days.
You know why they changed that? I believe it was in the 50s they changed that, the numbering system.
Just for ease of refereeing, I would guess.
Right, right. As being a former football official, you know that 50 through 79 are not eligible unless they had an eligible position. Now in the NFL, they got a report. They got it easier. Right. High school, they didn't have to report if they were, you know, they weren't eligible in high school, no matter what. You could run the ball, but you weren't eligible to catch a pass, a forward pass. So a little bit easier.
How should we do this one then?
I show four Hall of Famers in the Pro Football Hall of Fame that wore the number three some Hall of Famers wore number three, but people that wore the number three in a substantial number of seasons, let's say. Mm-hmm. And there's four of them. A couple of them are really big names. Let's reverse it a little bit tonight. Let's save those gentlemen for the end, and let's talk about the sort of the guys on the periphery that wore the number three.
Okay. All right. Well, you got one. That's a prospective Hall of Famer, right? Russell Wilson.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
The amazing thing about Russell Wilson, Pete Carroll, and the Seahawks that he plays on are just, I mean, A, the way that they are in contention every season, season after season, but B, the way nobody notices. The Seahawks are almost the parallel to the Patriots. Since Carroll took them over, always a threat to be in the Super Bowl, often thought to be at one point in the season the favorite in the NFC to win the championship. So, and he had some great teams too. So,
yeah, and did it most of the time without a significant offensive line. You know, poor guys like this past year, he's running for his life and still had a, you know. It was up for at some one point for being the NFL MVP for a while there. He was in a talk, you know. So
Russell, definitely a prospective Hall of Famer from this list. Now, you got another. Is Daryl LaMonica really not the Hall of Fame?
No, I don't. Not show Daryl LaMonica being in the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Wow, crazy! Because you know he was one of the guys that was the big name in the AFL. When that rogue league first started for the Raiders. And, I'm surprised.
Before the Raiders, he had his first 4 years with the Buffalo Bills.
Right.
Two AFL championships, I believe, where he was the starting quarterback of them. And then went to the Raiders. And I didn't realize he was with the Raiders as long as he was. He was with the Raiders from 67 through 74. So he overlapped Kenny Stabler quite a bit.
Yeah, right.
Right. I knew the 1 year they did, but I didn't realize he was still hanging around in there. But.
Oh yeah, he was there for a while. That's how I remember him from when I was a kid, you know, on the football cards. I'm surprised because he was like you just said. I mean, he was a big name in the NFL.
Well, I always one stat I love to look at with quarterbacks that have played a substantial amount of time is I like to look at their touchdown to interception ratio.
Of course.
And LaMonica had 100, this counts as AFL days with Buffalo and Oakland, 164 touchdowns, 138 interceptions. So he might not have been the best caretaker of the ball at, you know, some games. So,
well, the AFL was a much more free-flowing, much more risk-taking league anyways, right?
Right. So that might be one of the reasons why he's not in the Hall of Fame. Definitely had the longevity, 12 years altogether.
Well, Jesus, Joe Namath is in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
You know, that's always the argument, right? I mean, it's like Namath and LaMonica are very comparable. Very comparable, with the exception of the one big win, you know, which is not to sneeze at that, because I mean, basically that one win put the AFL on the map.
When you have a game called the Super Bowl versus an AFL championship,
right.
That makes a big difference. I think it's got the name Super right in it, you know.
It's a dead giveaway. So there are your perspective. Those are the two guys on this list that I would consider like real bubble Hall of Famers.
What do you think about a guy named Carson Palmer? He wore number 3 for...
Well, yeah, I was a big... Again, there was another guy. I talked last time about how I defended Matt Ryan. Carson Palmer was another guy I defended for a long time. History will not be nice to Carson Palmer, but... Those of us who saw him know that he was great. He was great. He just played on some really. I don't know. You're a generous guy, so let's say subpar teams in Cincinnati and Arizona.
The good teams that he played for were probably the Cincinnati teams, and he actually wore number 9 with Cincinnati.
Right.
It's when he went to Oakland and Arizona later in his career he put the 3 on. But. I thought he was outstanding out of he was a USC Trojan.
Yeah.
Came out, was a I remember this being a Steelers fan. He was a teammate of Troy Polamalu, and I think he came in the NFL a year before Polamalu did. So Polamalu's rookie year, I can remember, I think it was Polamalu's first game coming in, they were playing the Bengals. Carson Palmer at quarterback, and I forget who the Brokaw or somebody was, you know, doing the game, and they're like going, oh, you know, here Troy Polamalu and Carson Palmer were teammates, and now they're opposing each other. And boy, that really came to had a lot of history to it, because it was like 6-7 seasons that they opposed each other, you know, at least twice a year, and there's a couple playoff games in there that they played. But
and that also might have been the last, living in Southern California, I can tell you that might have also been the last time USC was any good.
That's
when they were on that team.
There might be some people that disagree with you, like Russell Wilson's coach that you just talked about. I mean, he might disagree with you a little bit.
I'm joking, but it feels like that these days. Have you seen the state of California college football? My God, it feels like that. But yeah, those are some great USC teams. Oh my God!
But I think what really, I mean, Palmer. It just seemed like everything was going so well for him. And then that playoff game against the Steelers, Kimo von Hoffen hit him, and I don't think it was a cheap shot. I think he got blocked, hit him down at the knee. It was a bad thing. And the Bengals were up in that playoff game, and they were looking pretty good. And it seemed to just deflate the whole balloon for the Bengals, and Carson Palmer's career seemed like right in that game. At least that's my perspective. And
the wheels literally came off.
Yeah, he just never was the same. And I think his knee was better, but he just wasn't the same. Like there was an uneasiness about him, you know. He's a little skittish, you know. Threw a lot more interceptions.
I'll tell you what. When you get to number 9, he's got to be in contention there, because that's a pretty obscure number.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm sure it is.
Even for the old days. So.
But even I mean, he threw a lot of interceptions after that. If he had a couple seasons. I guess 3 or 4 in the 20s, but his ratio 294 touchdowns to 187 interceptions, so 100 more touchdowns or so, more than 100, more than interceptions, and he had some bad years of throwing interceptions. His last few at the Bengals, they're pretty dismal. Okay, we got a bunch of other quarterbacks in there. What do you think about Jeff George? Jeff George were number 3.
Well, I don't know. Right after him, you've got Derek Anderson and Bobby Hebert. I might go with one of those two over George. I mean, isn't George like the stereotype backup?
Man, there is a guy that had all the skill sets. I mean, all the talent in the world coming out. And, I mean, even with –
Let's set this straight. With his first 4 years, he played for Indianapolis, wore number 11. Then played 3 years with Atlanta, wore number 1. Then he switched over to 3 with Oakland, Minnesota, Washington. So the latter part of his career, the backup role, yeah, he was a 3. But you got to talk about the man's entirety. Now, his touchdown, he had 154 touchdowns in his career, 113 interceptions. So a little bit more like on the LaMonica.
3-2.
Yeah.
3-2, basically.
But pretty close to what LaMonica was. And but a lot of teams he played for, 5 different teams. But I never thought he was. Yeah.
All odd numbers. I guess. I mean, there's something to be said for longevity here. I mean, he did start in how many? So 124 games plus playoffs. So there's something to be said for longevity there. But, jeez. If you can't put him in the same conversation as a Russell Wilson or even a LaMonica.
No, I think these gentlemen we're talking about right in here, they're probably...
This is the third tier.
Yeah, they're... I'm not even sure if they're going to make it on the Hall of the Very Good, you know, PFRA. I'm not so sure. Maybe Carson Palmer, but I don't know, sure. But...
I kind of like the idea of a Pro Football Hall of Very Goodness.
Oh, you've never heard of that with the PFRA?
I'm
a member of the PFRA.
Great.
We have the Hall of the Very Good. Every year we vote. And actually, it's unbelievable how many times a member of the Hall of the Very Good within a couple years goes into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So
do you have to take them out of the Very Good?
You know, I'm not quite sure. I think they get to stay there. They get that honor. I might be mistaken. I'll probably have Mr. Crippen or somebody calling me after this. I should know that better. But
My boy Doug Flutie had better be at least in the Very Good Hall of Fame.
I don't have that list. I'd get that on there. But okay, let's talk about some other guys sort of on that periphery. Derek Anderson, there's your perennial backup.
Yeah.
Had a real good year with the Browns. I'm not sure why they let him go, because I thought he played outstanding, even in the playoff game that they were way ahead of the Steelers. Steelers came back, beat him, but he had a great game. I don't know why. It wasn't his fault that they fell apart. Bobby Hebert, you know, there was a guy. I always liked Bobby Hebert. He sort of had some moxie to him, you know. Most of his career was with the Saints and played 4 years with the Falcons. 135 touchdowns, 124 interceptions. Ooh, that's a little bit more interceptions than I thought he had. Oh, I guess I only remember the good things about Bobby Hebert. I always liked him.
Oh, yeah. Well, he became like, I mean, it kind of shows the low expectations Saints fans have had since being formed in 72. But he became a almost legendary figure there for going, you know, 20-8 in his first two seasons as a starter, as his first two, let's say, full seasons as a starter. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's in the late 80s. And I mean, right. You know, that might have been in 88. I want to say
87. He was 10-2 as a starter.
Yeah,
88. He was 10-6.
I want to say one of those years was the first time they ever made the playoffs.
It could be.
I don't know.
They had
for
that
sure,
great defense.
Yeah, yeah. They just, you know, and Hebert was, as I remember, he was constantly manufacturing plays because, again, you know, victim of an average or below average offensive line. It seems to me that he ran quite a bit because he averaged, I think, 1 year he averaged something like 5 yards a carry. So he was definitely one of these scrambling quarterbacks of the new sort. But and then, you know, I don't know what happens. You know, he just kind of drops off the map when they lose him to Atlanta.
Well, he had, after that 10-6 season of 88, 89 he was 6-7 as a starter. 1990 he missed the entire season in a contract dispute. That sort of hurts your career a little bit.
That's weird.
Came back, had 2 more years with the Saints, 8-1 as a starter, 12-4 as a starter. And then Atlanta got their hands on him, and it sort of fell up. the wheels yeah. sort of fell off the truck there for him.
He turns 33 and he drops off.
Yeah. his last year, he was 3-10 as a starter and 25 interceptions. It was not a good year for Mr. Hebert in 1996.
I'm trying to think of who they replaced him with. Let's see. I'm trying to get this up here real quick. Who took over for him? Wade Wilson? Can that be?
Well, I think Aaron Brooks was coming in. We talked about him last week.
Yeah, right.
And so Aaron Brooks,
right.
I think, sort of bumped him off there.
You're right.
Okay, a couple other interesting ones. A gentleman still playing, Jameis Winston. What do you think of him as a number three?
I think Jameis Winston is a lot of fun. I was surprised that he got so little play this year. He finally did come in for Tampa Bay. No. Who's he with now? Green Bay?
No, he's with the Saints now.
The Saints, that's right. I remember.
He wore number three with Tampa Bay, and now he wears number two with the Saints. So we're going to talk mainly as Tampa Bay, because that's really where he played. He only had no starts this year. I think Tyson Hill got all the starts when Breeze was out.
Yeah.
But he did, he had 11 passing attempts, 7 completions.
Yeah.
So he did get in a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that nobody wants to take a chance on this guy. Yeah, he takes a lot of chances. You know, he makes bad decisions and stuff.
But does he really? Because his touchdown to interception ratio is not horrible. 121 touchdowns, 88 interceptions. That's not horrible.
But that's trending down, isn't it? I mean, last year was 30-30.
He had 30 interceptions in 2019. That was his worst year. Before that, his highest season was 2016. He threw 18 picks. So something happened 2019. It was probably Bruce Arians' offense where throwing the long ball. It's not his forte. You know, that's
and Arians is not exactly the most conservative coach in the world either. So
right. Yeah, I think he was a little bit more dink and dunk in his, and he thrived under that. You know, those first 4 years in the league.
Yeah, I like Jamias, but again, you know, you've got him in here with Wilson and even Hebert. You know, you've also got John Kitna here. Again, here's a guy I covered, and Joey Harrington as well. These are guys I covered. I mentioned last time that I covered the Raiders, but sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't speak bad about Joey Harrington, because a guy named with last name Chapman, I think that might be his boy. So.
So I was covering the Lions at about the same time as covering the Raiders. I got a lot of good beats in those days. And, you know, I mean, yeah, Kitna's a tough guy and all that stuff. And he really talks the talk and he puts his body out there and he's a great teammate and all that stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's 20-20 Phillip Rivers, you know, limited in skills.
When he was with the Bengals as a Steelers fan, I feared when Kitna came into the game. I'd rather have those starters than, because Kitna was just the poison for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
For some reason, when he was with Cincinnati, he owned you guys.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, mostly I know him from Detroit, where, you know, a lot of those guys were tough, really, but, you know, great team guys, but just not the, you know, the skills just aren't there, you know, so.
All right, I have three more on here, but we don't need to spend a lot of time with them because we need to get those Hall of Famers. But Brandon Whedon, Mark Sanchez, Rick Meyer, sort of all in the same boat. I mean, Sanchez had some success, got the two AFC championship games with the Jets, but ever since the butt fumble, I think his career sort of fell off a cliff, you know?
That's the thing. When you're remembered for something like that, you know. It's amazing because for a lot of my teenhood, Harold Baines was known as the dude who got thrown out by Bo Jackson, you know, from the wall, you know, from third base. Okay. He was known as this guy, but he made the Hall of Fame. in the end.
Yeah,
so right. It was just like, but the butt fumble is a bit more egregious than that. I mean, he wasn't playing Bo Jackson.
That's right. That's for sure. All right. Well, let's get into our Hall of Famers, because this is the meat and the potatoes of the number three jersey.
There's some good ones here.
Okay. We'll save the two big ones for last. How do you say that?
Let's see who you think the two big ones are.
All right. Well, maybe we disagree. But okay. Well, out of the Hall of Famers, I'm going to talk about the kicker first, because I think not that kickers are unimportant, but this guy's definitely good. Jan Stenerud in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, he's really one of the all time great place kickers, though.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean,
You can't besmirch this guy. Of course, he's most famous for kicking. Let's see. I guess it would have had to have been about 6 points in Super Bowl IV. The Chiefs win against a bunch of extra points and a field goal against the Vikings. Stenerud played forever, as I recall, and mostly for Kansas City. And I mean,
19 seasons.
Yeah, for a while, he was number two, I believe, all-time point scorer behind Blanda. For a while. Because he racked up a lot of points. He was around forever. And, I mean, this was a guy, he was basically the equivalent of Vinatieri in the day. I mean, he was the Adam Vinatieri of his day. And I think everybody agrees that Vinatieri is a Hall of Famer.
Oh, yeah.
So Stenerud was that. I mean, you talk about generational players. Okay, Stenerud was the generational place. He just was.
He had 13 seasons with Kansas City. Started in 1967, played through the 79 season. So think about those late 60s, early 70s Kansas City Chiefs teams. They're pretty good, you know. And he wore number 3 with Kansas City. Had 4 years with Green Bay from 83-83, wore number 10. And then his last 2 years, 84 and 85, with Minnesota, put the number 3 shirt on again. He was a great kicker. Definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, I've been saying there. But compared to our other three Hall of Famers, probably, he's in a big class with the jersey number 3. Now, the next one I'd like to talk about is Tony Canadeo.
Yeah.
Tony was born in May 5th, 1919, Chicago, Illinois. And he is another one that had a great nickname. They called him the Gray Ghost of Gonzaga. Those are some.
You stole my thunder, man. You stole my thunder.
Okay,
I was going to say he deserves mention for just the nickname here. But, the key thing about Canadeo is, I mean, look, he was the halfback, for Curly Lambeau's Packers in the 40s and 50s, And he was also a two-way player.
He
played pretty fair defensive back, and he did some punting, and he played special teams. So basically, he's like all three teams. And it's not just a one-off, he was regular defensive back and special teams returner, so... You gotta love the all-timer. He's in the Hall of Fame because these Green Bay Packers have dozens of guys probably in the Hall of Fame. And they say about Lambeau's teams, about Lombardi's teams, that some of the important things are is that they advance the game itself. They change the way people play it, and so you have to give props to Canadeo as a godfather of modern halfback play.
I think it was 12 seasons he played, 4.4 average per play, 31 touchdowns, first team all pro 1943, went into Pro Football Hall of Fame 1974. I mean, great career, especially two-way player. I mean, you got to be tired out there. You're playing offense, and you got to hit guys and tackle them and take on blocks.
That 4.4 yards per carry doesn't sound stunning, but you got to remember that before 1980, it seemed to me like off tackle run was the main play by the halfback. Oh, right. That was the main call, right? And, you know, it's a 2-yard play. So,
A gap, B gap play, you know, here.
Right, exactly. You didn't get too many reverses in those days. And so, you know, anybody that whose lifetime over 4 out of this era is noteworthy, basically. Mm-hmm. So.
All right. Well, now we come down to I'd consider the big two.
Yeah.
And I'll let you pick who we want to talk about next. They're both infamous names.
Okay. Well, all right. Let's talk Bronco Nagurski first. You can talk about Nagurski's accomplishments, and actually, you know, since he's a back, we actually have some statistics on him. But for me, the real key to Nagurski is he's really pro football's first household name, right? I mean, his reputation earned in college at Notre Dame. Of course, he brings that to the NFL. And, you know, it really, like, is that first step into giving the NFL the prestige that it has today.
Well, he wasn't Notre Dame. He was University of Minnesota.
I'm sorry, yeah.
He was a Golden Gopher.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. Bad slip. Sorry, Fighting Irish. Sorry, guys.
As an Irish fan, I'd love to have him on the Irish.
How about it? He had that reputation from college. He brings it to the pros. And he really, you know, puts it, because back in the day, college football was way more prestigious, was well more beloved than the NFL, than pro leagues, you know, which were fledgling. And you know, he was the guy who I really think had the American sports fan talking about pro football, you know, on this national level. He really garnered all the interest in the game. And plus, he was a pro wrestler. So I got to love that. I got to love the two sports stuff.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, being a two-way player. 1929, his senior season in Minnesota, he was voted as a first-team All-American at two different positions, yes, defensive tackle and a fullback. I mean, I don't know of anybody. I look at these every single day. I don't know if I've ever seen somebody in the same year make it a first-team All-American at two different positions. That's
especially those two. That's a weird. How do you have that size and that speed? You know,
I don't know, but just the name. I mean, that's another one of those names. It's just like, you know, I'm playing Bronco Nagurski today. That just sounds like a football name. You know, that's of course,
it's one of the great names. I mean, it's a Babe Ruth name. You know, it's like, yeah, that's a football name, Bronco Nagurski.
That just sounds angry. You know,
yeah, it sounds big and tough. So I mean, it's tough not to have Nagurski here at this number 3. He definitely makes the team. He's a legend. He's a legend in the true sense of the word.
Mm-hmm. He's an NFL champion, 1932 and 1933 with the Bears. He was part of that infamous play of that first championship game, I believe, where it was under dispute, where Red Grange, the rules back in the NFL back then, you had to be at least 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage to throw a forward pass. Mm. So, and I guess the Bears ran a play that was sort of right on the line. And Red Grange, and I forget who they were playing. I think they might have been playing the Portsmouth Spartans. And they ended up playing that championship game because Portsmouth had the better record, but the, you know, Hallis, he just couldn't have it. He challenged them to hey, we got to play this game because we were right behind you. And Portsmouth, they needed, like, the players needed money back then, so this is a great way to make some extra money. The coaches wanted some extra money. The fans loved it. So Portsmouth said, okay, we'll play you for the championship, even though we had the better record. They get down to the end of this game. Red Grange throws a pass. Apparently, he must have been close to the line of scrimmage, and passes it to Nagurski. Nagurski scores a touchdown. Bears win the game. Protest all over the place. You know, about, hey, you know, Grange was within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage. It's an illegal play.
Why didn't the coach just throw the challenge flag?
Because it's in black and white. They didn't recognize the red flag.
That's right. That's when the whole world was in black and white.
That's right.
And everybody moved around really fast, and everything was quiet. Yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay, great. Can we go on to my favorite?
Okay, you've been waiting for this for a long time. So yes,
this is the reason why I'm here. Okay, so I got an axe to grind. I'm still grinding this axe. That back in early 2020, the NFL did their special. They did a series, which was really awesome. A bunch of experts, including Bill Belichick, were on the show talking about the 100 greatest players of all time, of the first 100 years of the NFL, right? So a lot of people complain that Terrell Owens got stiff, because he did get stiff. But for me, by far the biggest omission, and really not even close, is Jim Thorpe. Now, granted, Thorpe was well more known for his college years, playing for the Carlisle Indians team that famously beat Harvard, that basically beat everybody. I mean, they were the best team for the teens, pretty much, under the guidance of Pop Warner, who... And I heard this, somebody said this one time, but you know you're important to the history of the sport when there is a level of the game named after you, such as Babe Ruth baseball. Yes, well, Pop Warner football sort of indicates how important Thorpe's coach was in college. Regardless, he was brought into the NFL because of his worldwide status as, you know, basically the greatest athlete of his day, having, you know, done so much damage at the 1912 Olympics, in which he won the pentathlon and the decathlon. And of course, you know, this was an inspiration for the Truly the Goats podcast. He's episode number one, in my opinion, the greatest athlete of the 20th century. But the NFL, when they were forming in 1920, brought him aboard for his reputation and also for his team, the Canton Bulldogs, who had been wreaking havoc all over Iowa, India, Pennsylvania, wherever they went, as one of the best semi-pro teams in the country. And they made him president. And so Jim Thorpe may be the only guy in any sport to be halfback commissioner.
Right.
That's quite a two-position player right there. Now, in the NFL, he ended up only playing 52 pro games. But, you know, he, again, not many statistics.
Statistic, though, just to be fair to him.
Right.
1920, when the roots of the NFL started, they considered that the NFL starting, Thorpe was 33 years old. So... I mean, look at in today's world of football. 33-year-olds are probably retiring, you know, or retired already. So Thorpe came in at 33. His last game that he played, he was 41 years old, as a tailback, halfback, whatever back he was for that particular year.
He's already this. Sports is really, really different 100 years ago in America. America never really, for one reason or another, took on the sports club model that they had in Europe and that they still have in Europe. In Europe, you don't have minor leagues, right? You have, like, subdivisions of your team and stuff, but those are youth teams. What you do is, literally, when you're 10, you decide that your parents decide that they want you to get some exercise. And so you go to the local sports club. And if you're good enough, they'll put you on a team. And, you know, for example, when I was living in Budapest, you know, our local team was at Budapest. And let me tell you, their sports club had gymnastics, soccer, hockey, basketball, any sport you can think of, figure skating, any sport you can think of.
Wow.
And that's the way they do it there, right? That they don't have minor leagues and stuff. It's all community-based rather than, guess what, business-based, like it is here. Okay. So in the U.S. at the time, it was highly, highly ragtag, right? I mean, Jim Thorpe came out of the 1912 Olympics, obviously couldn't go back to college, right?
Right, right.
You know, and so he said, what am I going to do? Well, so what he started doing was he said, oh, I'm going to go play professional baseball, you know? And then in the off season, he went and he played semi-pro football, right? Because of his Carlisle days. So when you say he debuted at 33 in the NFL, it's kind of like saying that Arvydas Sabonis, you know, debuted in the NBA at age 32. You know, he actually had this whole other sports career.
Well,
let me rephrase
what I was saying. Let's say that Thorpe was same athlete he was, but born 10 years later in life, so that in 1920 he was 23 coming in the NFL, which, I mean, besides the Olympics, he was definitely a better football player than he was baseball career-wise.
That was his best sport.
So a 23-year-old Thorpe coming into the NFL and playing for, you know, 52 games, you have a much different athlete and probably cracks your NFL 100 with no problem.
Easy. You know? Well, I mean, my theory is that the reason why he doesn't crack the top 100 along with Nagurski didn't either, is simply because they don't have video. That's it. Now, that's kind of a cop-out.
Well, did Red Grange make it?
That's a good question. I don't think so, though. I think
that's
the
surprising.
Earliest, even though they called it 100 for 100, I think that the farthest back they went was Sammy Baugh. I think he was the oldest, and he was in like the late 30s, early 40s. So I think he was really as far back as they went. And they showed a bunch of still pictures, basically. You know, they did the Ken Burns thing, you know, where they show pictures and just kind of slowly focus in on it, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, Thorpe kind of doesn't get the recognition he deserves, but, you know, when I did the Truly the Goats episode, I spoke to the guy who's the curator at the Jim Thorpe Museum and Oklahoma Sports Hall of Fame. And, you know, in his opinion, and there's something to be said for this, in his opinion, and, you know, he has a point there. Also, if you're a Republican, you can thank Jim Thorpe for making Eisenhower president. Because if Eisenhower and his buddy on the Army team hadn't decided to go after Jim Thorpe and both get knocked out of the game, Eisenhower with a broken leg, you know, he might never have chosen the career path that he did. And might have been a football player. So thank Thorpe for beating the hell out of Eisenhower in the Army-Carlisle game. That also gets him on the number three team, if you ask me. Yeah, exactly. Well, for one day in 1919,
okay, we gotta say it. You gotta get that "I like Ike" in there, you know. Well, there's not a lot of stats on Thorpe's NFL career, but I do see he kicked field goals. And there's not many of them, but there's not every year is recorded. And what I'm looking at the Pro Football Reference website on Thorpe, and but still to be an all-star tailback, have the career that he did, to, you know, win the pentathlon, win the decathlon, the Olympics,
see, for me,
be a major league baseball player,
and to
kick field goals. That's just
NFL
an all-round athlete. Yes.
Or a lot of these sports, I often have to consider the guys with the shorter careers, right? Just because of the effect. I mean, the truth is that one of the greatest guys ever to play NFL football is Bo Jackson. No one will ever talk me out of that. I don't care if he only played 4 years or whatever. It doesn't matter. If you saw him, you knew. If you saw him in college, you know. you know, he was an all-time great. You know, for basketball, I always talk about Sabonis. You know, another one is Drazen Petrovic. You may remember this guy. He played back, and he came up in the league right about the same time as Michael Jordan. He had already been winning championships in the Yugoslavia before then. Mm-hmm. And this guy was primed to be, you know, the second or third best player in the NBA. Unfortunately, in one of the off seasons, he has a car crash. You know, dies before he can even hit his prime. Okay, for me, Petrovic is still one of the top 10 European players of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Easy. And so for me, Thorpe, well, he was born out of time, but that doesn't take away his greatness at all. Well, thank God.
Yeah. But people are still talking about him to this day. I mean, how many players other than
Thorpe,
Redgrange, Nagurski, I mean, how many people from 100 years ago are still being talked about as much as... In football, you know, of course, you have Babe Ruth and Gehrig and everything.
Right. And absolutely. And, you know, and again, this goes back to truly the GOATs, man. When Thorpe, people talk about
one of the biggest names still to this day.
Let's think about this. Again, you know, we did the last episode and we hit on Matt Ryan for probably longer than you wanted to. But in 30, 40 years, you know, who's going to think Ryan when they think of the top 10 quarterbacks of the 2018s? You know, who's going to. Not too many people. A lot of people in Atlanta, you know, but, you know, I mean, so again, like, Thorpe is kind of the opposite.
Right.
You know, thank God people are still talking about this guy, because what he did in so many ways was so important. And for the history of the NFL.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's change tunes here a little bit. I mean, I think we've covered all the significant players that were number three. Okay. And you have, last night we talked about your Truly the GOATs podcast, but you have sort of a new endeavor you've been doing on the Sports History Network.
Sure. Well, the SHN Showcase.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the showcases and what they can expect if they're going to listen to
that? I tend to think that the Sports History Network has a niche. There's a certain subsection of sports fans that's really into the history. And I don't just mean, you know, memorizing the Super Bowl winners or something. I mean, like, interested in the development of the game, the rules, the technology even of the game. And so for me, what I'm hoping to do with the Sports History Network is sort of introduce those geeks, and I mean that in the best possible way, to more geeks. Let's all come together, because, again, there's a certain type of person that geeks out on hearing a podcast about Super Bowl VII. You know, as is the case with Lombardi Memories. There's some kind of person, hopefully, that enjoys... Actually, I had one person tell me it was their favorite, Truly the GOATs, that geeks out on hearing about a sumo wrestler 300 years ago. And so with the showcase, I'm hoping to turn people on to the really... You know, really good work that's done with these Sports History Network podcasts, but just doesn't get that much exposure, because I'm afraid that not so many sports fans really care about history. But I know who you are, and I want to appeal to you. That's right.
You know what? I mean, I've listened to your episodes. I was on one of your episodes of the showcase, and it's. For the listeners, I think what it really does is you listen to, you know, Arnie Chapman. You hear him as a football history dude. You've heard 100 and umpteen, you know, editions of his podcast. But you never really get to know who Arnie Chapman is. You hear who Arnie Chapman's interviewing. You get to learn a lot about his guests. But you never really get to learn about Arnie. And this, I think you've done that so well with all your guests you've had on so far on the showcase, of introducing the other side to them, to the viewership and the listenership, to get to know that person a little bit. And I think that just really opens up another channel into that personality of that host that people can enjoy. And I know I've enjoyed it, and it's a really a fun podcast. Now,
and I think it would be kind of funny. I always thought what would be a funny idea for a podcast is this, okay? Because I do a lot of work in gambling. So I do a lot of writing for sports betting. And I was thinking what would be a funny idea for a podcast is to debate the NFL lines for the week, but it would be me debating myself. Right, so that way, I could give the case for Saints minus three, but also Falcons plus three. Right? Right! One of my guys is always going to win, right? So,
and you can never be, you're never wrong. You always have a right answer. You could be one of those guys say, hey, stick with me. I'll give you the pick of the week. I'm always right. I was 100% last week, but I was also 100% wrong. Well, as we only have a couple minutes left here, anything else you're working on coming up in the future? You talked a little bit about some future episodes of Truly the Goats and maybe some SHN showcases. What do you have coming up that we can listen to and look forward to?
Oh, wow. Well, Truly the Goats has been a little bit difficult to plan ever since COVID set in. So basically for the past year, it's weird the way people's schedules got messed up and how contacting people got more difficult. Let's see. But earmarked, I would like to do something on the greats of the Negro Leagues because many, many exciting things have been happening with Negro League history recently. Especially with the Hall of Fame in Kansas City, a lot of interesting things are happening. So I'd like to do that. I would like to talk Irish sports. So I actually do have somebody lined up for that. I found some superstars in both hurling and Gaelic football. And let me tell you, for football fans, Gaelic football is a trip. I mean, you should check it out. It's kind of like a combination of football and rugby. It's really dope. It's a very interesting game. Very interesting. Oh, it's a very interesting game. Really neat to watch. If you like passing and stuff, it's a great game. Because, it looks a lot like human table tennis. And then let's see what else. Oh, well, I'd really love to do a story on Ora Mae Washington, who is probably the greatest NBA Hall of Famer that nobody's ever heard of. So I'm working on that. And then I would really like to do a piece on Secretariat. There is I would like to ask the question, is an animal an athlete? Can we consider them an athlete? Well, you watched that record-setting Secretariat race, and that's one of my all-time favorite clips on YouTube. Is Secretariat winning by like 30 lengths or whatever at Preakness or at Belmont. Just incredible. Just incredible. So in any case, that's kind of what I got planned for Truly the Goats, of course, for Sports History Network showcase. It's Arnie, keep getting new people in the rotation so I can have more subjects to talk about.
Well, that's a great conversation we had with Oz Davis, and we appreciate him coming on and thank all of our guests who have been coming on. And most of all, we appreciate you, our listeners, for joining us on the SportsHistoryNetwork.com and Pigskin Dispatch podcast, because we just love to have you here, and we would be nothing without your listenership and your input. If you wanted to tell us something maybe we missed in our conversations today, you can email me at pigskindispatch@gmail.com. Let us know who you think number three that you would like to have heard about, and we'll take a look at that, do some research on it, and put it on a later podcast. And anything else you want to talk about, again, pigskindispatch@gmail.com. You can catch us every day by hitting that subscribe button. You'll know as soon as it releases. Our friends out there in the internet world will give you that notification to know it's released. And you can also find us at the sportshistorynetwork.com, as well as other great podcast on sports history with some great hosts and some great guests. You'll really enjoy that place. And our flagship website, pigskindispatch.com/podcast. You can catch all of the podcasts of the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch and do some binge listening, or go back and find some of the episodes you really liked and you want to hear again, and some of our guests that we have on, and we'll really enjoy having you here. So until tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.